Good evening, everybody. Thanks for being here again this evening. You know, I thought that would make a good name for a boy band. You could take that so many different directions. First of all, Bach was not even a reformer, but we're talking about him tonight, so he had to go in the title. So he could be the keyboard player, right? Because that's what he was known for. Luther could be the moody lead solo singer that doesn't get along with anybody. And on down the line, perhaps Calvin could be the backup vocals in a stroke of poetic justice, since he didn't believe in singing harmony. I don't know. Melanchthon could be the drummer. You could keep going on and on and on. But we won't. Instead, we'll show the sources here, which are the same as last time, on the third talk, which will be next week, our ultimate week. There will be an additional source or two, which I will list as we move into the 20th and 21st centuries. But just a brief overview of what I'm hoping to cover tonight. We are going to begin with notable texts, which we didn't quite get to last time, which was okay. Then we will pick up with the Renaissance and the Reformation and a little bit of Counter-Reformation, about 2.5 minutes of Counter-Reformation. And then we'll finish off tonight by talking more in depth about the Baroque era and Johann Sebastian Bach. So just a little bit of review. We talked last time about the medieval era, which lasted roughly 1,000 years, 450 AD to 1450 AD. We talked about Gregorian chant, right, and how composers from the Notre Dame Cathedral, music directors, started taking Gregorian chant and adding parts to it, duplum and triplum and quadruplum, etc., etc., which is starting to get us more towards the sort of four-part hymns that we sing today, right? We'll talk more about what music directors would have had to do back in the day. But for now, I thought we could talk just a little bit about the Kyrie. The Kyrie, as we discussed last time, was the first movement of the Catholic Mass, right? It is in what language? Greek, that's right. All the rest of the Mass is in Latin, but the Kyrie is in Greek. And it starts off with the text, Kyrie eleison, which means, Lord, have mercy. So that's why if you heard the Good Friday, Lord, have mercy piece that we started the program with, it starts with the English, Lord, have mercy, and then it goes to the Greek, which, of course, you see there. This is an ABA format, which means that we have the B section, Christe eleison, which, of course, is the same as the Kyrie, except for Christ have mercy being the translation, instead of Lord being either God the Father or Jesus, right? But specifically to Christ. And then we go back to Kyrie eleison. And that's the whole text of the Kyrie eleison. And composers can stretch this out for many, many minutes. I do believe that the one from Good Friday was at least 5 or 6 or 7 minutes, depending on how fast or slow we went, right? But of course, how do you stretch that all out? And I'll tell you, as a composer, you repeat a lot. And you repeat words a lot, right? And then you sing them very, very slowly. And that's how you get 7 minutes out of 6 words right there. So let's hear just a little bit of some settings of the Kyrie eleison that perhaps you've heard, right? Notice this comes from the Mass. This is not a Protestant text. However, it's still appropriate to beseech the Lord for mercy. And since we did have it in the Good Friday service, I thought, you know what? Let's put it on the agenda here tonight. So let's hear a little bit of this here. Talk more about Palestrina a little bit later on. You can hear it is a cappella, literally meaning in the chapel. And so you're singing without any instrumental accompaniment. And you can hear it's very floral and going a lot of different directions, right? Believe it or not, this is one of the more subdued versions of the Kyrie from the Renaissance era. Very typically, there would be many, many voices overlapping and weaving in and out amongst each other, which is part of what leads to the Counter-Reformation with the idea that there's too much consuming going on. This is Baroque. Hopefully you can hear how it's easier to tell what's going on with the text, because it's more everybody's kind of moving at the same pace and doing the same thing with the lyrics. This is Schubert from the Schubert Mass in G. It's very beautiful. It doesn't sound very Kyrie-ish to me personally. Sounds like everything is hunky-dory. So Lord have mercy. Why don't you? It's an interesting approach, right? And composers hopefully think about these things as they are setting the text. Not sure what Schubert was thinking, and it's pretty hard to ask him now, but it's a beautiful piece of music. Just not very despondent. Still, I wanted to put it here in the lineup because it's pretty famous, and it's a good one to hear. Now, the last one up for today is from the Mozart Requiem, which is the Requiem Mass, and this is actually a double fugue that he writes, and it's pretty angsty, so I think you'll hear the crying out for help in this setting. So, due to the nature of the fugue, I had a friend once who said, "I can give you the definition of a fugue." I said, "Great, tell it to me." He said, "The instruments enter one by one, and the audience members exit one by one." Yikes. You heard that from him, not from me. Due to the nature of the fugue, though, there's a lot going on, right, and overlapping. But you can also hear that this is very regimented because it is from the classical era, and they're very big on balance and structure. Again, the classical era was known as the Age of Enlightenment, so science, reason, less supernatural emphasis as were in the eras previous to this. So that's a little bit about the Kyrie. Let's now talk about the Magnificat. What is the Magnificat? Anybody? Mary's Song. That's right. Now, this one is straight out of the Bible. "My soul magnifies the Lord." And, of course, there's the whole passage on it there. And I thought we could just listen to some different settings. We have, of course, sung this at different times here at the church. We sang a setting at the Lessons and Carols service last Christmas. Who was that by, Tim?
Dyson,
yeah, that sounds right. That sounds right. That's right, that's right, from the Magnificat in D. Or, Service in D major, right? Yeah, the Magnificat from the Service in D. Thank you for that. I don't remember which one I have up first, but I think it's Palestrina again. Let's find out. See what else we've got. Is this the rudder? This might be the rudder. Rudder is interesting because I personally like his setting of the Magnificat quite a lot. I have choral friends who don't. They feel it's a bit trite and a bit... I think the story is that Rudder wrote part of his Magnificat setting in the time frame when he had just been to a Broadway show. And so some of it sounds a little bit cheesy, maybe. Again, I don't have an issue with it, but some people do, so you can see what you think. This is the Rudder. So I don't know. A little bit. It does. It does sound a little like West Side Story. Yes. Little kick line throw in there, right? Let's hear another example here. So you can hear that there's a lot of different ways that composers choose to set, and these are only a handful, right? Just because we only have so much time for the evening. Now the Te Deum, if you were at the concert, what was it, 2 weeks ago, I believe, the 125th anniversary choral concert, we sang, of course, the Te Deum setting by Anton Bruckner. And I thought it would be interesting to just talk a little bit about the parts of the Te Deum. So you first have the praise to the Trinity, and the English translation is up there because that's the language that I speak. So they have to know what's going on up there, right? Then we have praise of Christ specifically, and then prayers and petitions. And if you want to look into this more, I found this layout on Wikipedia, so there it is. But if you go through it, you can find that it lines up with the setting of this. Let's listen to a couple of Te Deum settings. I don't remember which one is first, so we're about to find out. Handel. It's Handel. This would be awkward if I was not remembering these. That's right. Singers are doing great so far. Okay, now, here is an interesting thing. This is in the English text, right? Who can tell me why are many of Handel's works in English? Because he lived in England, that's right. He was a German speaker, but he lived in England for much of his career, which is nice for me, because as I just mentioned, that's the language that I speak, it's English. Now, let's hear a little bit of the Bruckner, which we're well familiar with. a little bit of what is perhaps my personal favorite setting of the Requiem. This is by Latvian composer Eschenvalds, which is also in English. And let's hear a little bit of it now. So those are all good ones to listen to in entirety if you have time. That is a contemporary period. Yeah, he's a living composer. It has more of that vibe, doesn't it? Yes, sir. I also think it's interesting that we have a Te Deum setting in our own hymnal. Again, that's part of what we're talking about in the talks tonight. And it is number 103. I thought I would play just a little bit of that, just in case it doesn't come to mind for you. Here it is. And so on, and so on. It's a great hymn. You can see we have a bit of a rewording. As Pastor talked about earlier, to make it fit in the meter, right? But the essence of the text remains unchanged, which is pretty great. All right, so let's now move on just a little bit to the Renaissance and the Reformation and what's going on at this time. Just a little bit of review. We talked about Wycliffe last time, right? He's a little ahead of his time, right? Because the Reformation doesn't really start until 1450, so he's a little bit before this, and it goes till about 1600, so what, 150 years-ish? He's got all sorts of problems with the Roman Church, right, which figures for reformers and such. Of course, he's not properly a reformer, right, because he's not in the Reformation, but he's got those same sort of views. And he does translate the Bible into English, believing that everyone should be able to read it in their native tongue. And he's not a big fan of the polyphonic music. Polyphonic just meaning that there's multiple voices doing independent things. We talked about that, weaving in and out of each other, obscuring the text. He's not a fan of obscuring the text there. And, of course, last time we read the quote in which he did not pull any punches about how he felt about this. Here's a picture of Wycliffe, ready to strike with his rod. Yeah. All right, let's talk a little about Luther. Now, of course, we have had many, many discussions of Luther. Was it a year and a half ago, Pastor Rush did a series on Luther, right? So we won't talk about Luther a whole bunch, but I do think that Luther and his relationship to music is interesting, to me anyway. So we know about 1517 when Luther nails the 95 Theses to the door of the church. And of course, this was not him trying to pick a fight per se, although it was Luther, so, you know, he was a little cantankerous all the time, right? He actually prints this in Latin. He's a scholar. He's a highly trained lawyer, right, and a monk. So he's a lot of education, and he's hoping to have an intellectual debate, essentially. But, of course, folks get a hold of it and translate it and use the newly developed printing press to circulate it all over town, and everybody starts reading it and commenting on it and thinking about it, right? Luther had some similar criticisms to those of Wycliffe, in terms of the scriptures and indulgences and so on and so forth. And there's Luther in his attire right there. Now, as far as Luther and music, that is a very interesting subject. Luther loved music. He's a trained monk, and so he knows how to sing well and how to sing psalms and hymns, etc. Something that I did not know is that Luther was not so much that he needed to get rid of the Mass as much as we needed to change the Mass to make it more appropriate for the masses, so to use a somewhat dumb pun right there. Because at different points, you know, the congregation wouldn't sing. Sometimes the organ would play entire verses by itself of a hymn. Like the people would sing for a while, and then the organ would play for a while, and then the people would come back in. So Luther's big idea was, well, we can keep a lot of that, but it needs to be in the vernacular, and people need to be involved, right? Luther did, he was a big fan of congregational singing, and Lutheran schools taught their boys to lead congregational singing, which we do at the church here as well with both our sons and our daughters in the children's choirs, which we just heard the other day, which was really nice. Luther also would translate hymns from the Latin into the German, and he would pair these, as we were, Pastor was talking about this as well, he would pair these with different tunes, and then he would write his own hymns and his own tunes. A Mighty Fortress is probably the most famous. You know, we sing it at least once a year, every year, sometimes more. I have a couple of different recordings of this, so it's interesting to me that some of you will know this already. The Mighty Fortress that we hear today, where all the rhythms are equal and everybody sings in four parts and it's nice and big and majestic and grand, is not how Luther's Mighty Fortress would have started out. Let's hear a little bit of that.
I press and hold his bones and nuts.
Of course, this changed little by little over the years till we get what we're familiar with today, right? I do have a recording of this on the organ. We tend to think of a Mighty Fortress as being with an organ because it sounds, in the academic terms, awesome. But Luther, you know, many congregations during his day may not have had an organ at all, right? Luther himself was a vocalist and played the lute, which was a sort of guitar accompaniment instrument looking thing. That's also an academic term. but I do have a recording with the organ. It's pretty great. This arrangement was composed and performed by the Diane Bish, who I believe did perform here at our very own church at one point in time. A new song, I believe it was. There you go. And I'm told it was quite good. All right, let's talk a little about Zwingli and Calvin, because Zwingli and Calvin were not as supportive of music and worship, let's just put it that way, as Luther. So Zwingli, isn't that a neat name? Ulrich Zwingli. He was a talented instrumentalist, but he did not place emphasis on music in worship. His idea was that music could be outside of worship, and that was great. But he was not such a fan of music in the worship service. Luther, as we mentioned earlier, had no issues with taking whatever tunes he came across, whether it was a folk tune or another popular song, and pairing it with a hymn text. Because all the folks knew it, why not sing it? Calvin said, no, no, we're not going to have any of that because it's tainted by association. That was the idea that Calvin carried. And so if you had, say, a popular drinking song, then that would not be appropriate to use in worship because everyone's going to think of going down to the bar, et cetera, et cetera. Which, you know, there's something to that perhaps, right? There's a balance in many things, right? Calvin also believed that a very minimal amount of sacred music outside the scriptures was appropriate. So, you know, there's certain Presbyterian groups that only sing psalms. This would be the idea of where this comes from, right? Sort of that bent right there. Calvin has actually somewhat of a scathing quote here about how the Old Testament used instruments. Let's have a look at it. Let them come from heart and mouth. Okay, so singing. Don't use instruments, but singing is good. And in the vulgar tongue, also good. Instrumental was only tolerated in the time of the law because of the people's infancy. Ouch. So that's an interesting thing to ponder there. As a result, most of the singing that went on in Calvinist circles at the time, they would not sing in harmony. Everyone would sing the tune or the melody. And, of course, instruments would not be incorporated. Certainly no organs. That would be a matter of popish thievery. And here's Zwingli with his hat. A lot of these reformers have really good hats, you know, or really good beards. Now, something that's very useful, I would say, there's probably a better word for that, is the Genevan Psalter that came out of this, right? And this was highly influential and adapted by many composers and arranged for instruments as well. This was put together by Louis Bourgeois. And so if you look at the old 100th on your table there, you'll see it's from his Genevan Psalter. And basically, they said, set all of these psalms, all 150, which were made into the meter, etc., in music. Of course, this wasn't in English, right? So we've had to have somebody move it into the English for us, right? So this, of course, would not be the way we sang it tonight, where you have the four lines of music. It probably would have been just the one line, and then later on that would have been added in, is my guess. There we go. It's a monophonic setting. Mono just meaning there's only one line of music, the melody or the tune. We have several of these in our Trinity hymnal. Number one, which we just sang this very evening. Of course, the doxology. Comfort, comfort ye my people. Now Israel may say, and that in truth. And there's the doxology there. Let's hear a little bit of comfort, comfort ye. Some of you will recognize this, I'm sure. Of course, that's not how that one started out either. If you hear this oftentimes at, this gets sung sometimes at Lessons and Carols service, and it's usually a little more lilty. Who's heard it like this? Okay, so several people have, right? Of course, the rhythm has changed much like A Mighty Fortress did as well. And here we have a picture of Calvin and Calvin Klein. Yes, Gretchen. Geneva Jigs, I'll have to come back to that. Because I'm not familiar with Geneva Jigs. Let's come back to that at the end, for sure. So, for those on the audio, this was a German joke. So, thank you. I do what I can. So let's talk a little about Palestrina. You know, it's a good Italian name if it sounds like spaghetti. Palestrina. Let's go, he said. Or not. He was Italian. He was Catholic. The reason I mention this is because many of these composers during this era are like the Italians are working for the Protestants, right? We're talking about this. But he's what's part of the Counter-Reformation. Essentially, we have the Council of Trent, and they get together and they say, can we repair things with the Protestant group? Well, they waited way too long for that, so that wasn't about to happen. But they said, okay, what about all this music being too muddled and all of that stuff that Wycliffe was saying a long time ago, etc., right? And they agreed that, yes, our music is getting a bit complex and you can't understand the words. And so essentially, so I've read, Palestrina basically comes in and they said, you need to write your music more simply or get rid of it altogether. And he said, no, I can make this work. And so he kind of kept them from going further, perhaps, than they did, is what they say. And, here's a picture of Palestrina ready to pen his next masterwork. All right, so since we've been talking about Luther, let's talk a little bit more about Lutheran influence of hymns that are in our hymn book. All right, so we've got a few here. Some of these you'll recognize right off the bat just by the title. We have Jesus Lives and So Shall I by Johann Kruger. And of course, we sang that this evening, which is why we picked that there. Bach, some of these different settings, such as O Sacred Head, Now Wounded, are not actually by Bach, but they were arranged by Bach for different pieces that he would incorporate them into. And what does that mean? When I first heard this, that Bach didn't actually write all of his pieces, I was sort of scandalized. I thought, oh, Bach, he's my favorite composer, and, you know, he wrote so much music, and he's, you know, so revered, and he didn't even write all of his music. Well, I didn't understand. It's more of an arrangement. Like, let us say that we have hymn 460, which is Amazing Grace. We could play it much like it is in the hymnal. Pretty straight away, right? No issues there. However, a lot of times, who's heard of the term the Baptist hand? Okay, we've had at least one person. So James, what does the Baptist hand refer to? Yeah, they add stuff, right? And it's usually not written down, but it's usually just intuitive, right? So it might have something more like this. Or finally, you might have something like this. So these were all renditions and settings, right, of Amazing Grace. So Bach would do the same thing when he would take a hymn that had already been pre-written, and he would do it his own way, essentially, right? So that's kind of what we have here with these different Bach hymns. If it says arranged by Bach, that's what's going on at the bottom of the hymn there. Okay, let's keep going. Let's talk a little about the organ. As we said earlier, It's originally not meant to accompany congregational singing, but rather to take the place of the congregation, I guess, to give them a break or something. I'm not sure what they were doing when they weren't singing. We did talk about how the Calvinists went through and got rid of all the organs, which you can see if we're following off of Calvin's thoughts there, it makes sense why this would have happened, right? We think of, you know, a Lutheran church having a mighty big organ in the back, right? It's a sort of strong presence there. But actually, until the end of the 16th century, it wasn't such a big thing as perhaps it might be today. All right, the big finish for tonight. Johann Sebastian Bach. So we're done with the Renaissance, and now we've moved back into the Baroque era. Last time we got through the Baroque and the Classical, and now we're just backtracking a little bit because Bach is such a great figure. We're going to talk about him some more before we move on in our third lecture next week to come through the present day. Hopefully, that's the plan. So Bach was a Lutheran, and of course he was on the slide that had the Lutheran influences there. He was known as being a really, really good organist. Apparently, we can see here there's a quote that talks about Bach, and it says, "The organ resounded with such fullness and so penetrated the ears of those present like a thunderbolt." That's quite a review right there. Now, Bach wrote a lot of different music, because back in the day, music directors of a church would not only have to do everything that our music director, Tim Renner, does, which is manage multiple different choirs, multiple different ensembles, arrange music for the settings. What else, Tim? Hire musicians, etc., etc. It's a long list, right? But they also had to compose new music for every service, as well as sometimes teach non-musical classes such as Latin. I'm personally glad that we've sort of switched that around these days. As a musician, I would prefer to stick to the music, which Bach did too, apparently. He apparently hired somebody out to teach his Latin classes. Sounds pretty strategic to me. Let's talk a little about Bach's family. Bach actually had 20 children, so he's kind of famous for that. I always put that as a bonus question on my music appreciation quizzes. I always say, how many kids did Bach have, and is Hildegard von Bingen still alive? Now, Hildegard von Bingen was a female composer during the medieval era, so you can bet your boots, as my grandma used to say, she ain't alive. And yet, we'll leave that there. Wilhelm Friedemann Bach was one of those composer children of Bach's. Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach, who's known as the Berlin Bach. Johann Christian Bach, known as the London Bach. He was sort of a mentor to Mozart. So he lives in the era after his father. He's probably the next most famous after his father of all the Bachs. Johann Christoph Bach. And I also like to say J.C. Penney Bach. It's not a real Bach, but I like it all the same. There's a picture of Bach right there. And I've got some music of Bach. There's so much music of Bach in this lecture that I don't remember what this is, so let's find out. Oh, it's Jesu Joy. And I know that everyone here has heard this at one point or another, because the strings play it every year. The choir has sung it multiple times in the past couple of years. So what Bach did was he took this sung part, which was a pre-existing hymn, and he decided to wrap other musical stuff around it, which is his own arrangement, which makes it so genius, because the hymn was already nice, but then he added a whole another several layers to it. All right, this, I believe, is the Bach. We talked about the oratorio with Handel last time and how it's a lot like an opera, but it's usually sacred material. And this is Bach's Christmas Oratorio, and I just like it a lot, so we're going to listen to the beginning. Of this text are Christians be joyful. Of course, it's not in English, so it's Bach und Fröhlichen or something like this. That sounded passable, I think. But you can feel it in the music. You can feel Bach's joy that he really believed what he was doing. Okay, and lastly, we have the chorale from the Jesu Joy, as it is in its original form, and I don't remember the name of the gentleman who wrote it, but we'll hear it here. All right. So Bach decided to take a trip, and that's why he said, I'll be Bach. He was running to get to the choppa. Okay, we'll rein this in here. So Bach was a bit like Luther in that he had somewhat tenuous relationships with his employers. Bach, to put it nicely, Bach could be a bit of a piece of work. Bach apparently went to see, so he gets his first job at age 20. He goes to see Buxtehude. Buxtehude was a notable organist who was also a Lutheran. And so he took 4 weeks off, but he spent a little more time than that. He spent 4 months instead of 4 weeks, which, as you can imagine, landed him in some trouble when he got back. Not exactly sure what he was planning to do with his post during those 4 months, but I guess it worked out because he kept writing music. I find it funny that it was commented in his new position that he had played rather too long. So basically his communion music was running longer. You know how our organist always times it up so nicely that it ends up just when the pastors are ready? I guess Bach didn't do that. So they said something to him, so then he played too short. It's just kind of funny that we tend to overcorrect, right? Right. Bach was a Lutheran pietist, which was a big part of why he put all of himself into his music. He apparently landed himself in jail one time because he disagreed with his employer, who was the Duke of something or other. So if you argue with a high up like that, you go to jail. But he wrote some more music, so I guess it worked out in the end. He would often end his compositions. We talked about Soli Deo Gloria in the Reformed Rubrics just a few weeks ago. Bach loved this phrase and would often end his compositions with SDG for this. You'll notice that Dr. Renner also used this in the program notes for the 125th anniversary program. And I love this here, that he expressed his desire to work towards the goal, namely a well-regulated church music to the glory of God. So you see that Bach, he had no pretensions, although he could be irritable. He apparently once was quoted as saying, "Bring me my coffee before I turn into a goat." And I can guarantee you he did not mean greatest of all time. But he also said that the aim and final music goal of all music should be none other than the glory of God and the refreshment of the soul, which personally I resonate with quite nicely. So it's part of the reason I like Bach quite a lot. Bach also was not intending that his music was to be left behind as some legacy. Rather, he needed music for church, and so he would crank it out. I think he had a saying where he said, "I've been industrious because I had to be. Those who are equally obliged to be industrious will have just as much music." Something like this, right? It was actually Felix Mendelssohn who came in the Romantic era, which is after the Classical era, which is the late 1800s, who also was Jewish but became a Lutheran as well, did the St. Matthew Passion, and Bach became an established composer in music history. Okay, just for time's sake, I'm going to skip these two pieces quickly. We already talked about him putting the stick between his teeth so he could reach more notes on the organ. We have to talk a little about the St. Matthew Passion. You can't talk about Bach without talking about the Passions. It's an oratorio, not unlike Handel's Messiah. So there's different arias, there's different chorale settings, and different recitatives. This was actually written for soloist, double choir, and double orchestra, which is interesting because he had a choir chancel sort of down below, which he would stick his first choir and his first orchestra down there. And then he had one kind of up in the balcony, and he would stick everybody else up there too, which I believe was rather small, so that must have been quite a trick to try to fit. It wasn't a big balcony like we have here at the church, right? It's a setting of Matthew 26 and 27 with other chorales and church hymns and things like that. So he would put church hymns because people would recognize them, and then they could maybe sing along if they wanted to do this, and so on and so forth. Bach was said to have written 5 Passion settings. Only 2 full ones actually survive, including the St. Matthew. And sometimes he's known as the 5th evangelist because so much of his music is focused on the Gospels, and so he's communicating through his musical art. Let's listen a little bit to this chorale. This is O Sacred Head Now Wounded. Okay, so I want to leave just a couple minutes for questions because I know the choir has to go momentarily. Gretchen, what were you saying about the jigs? Uh-huh. Geneva jigs. Oh, I see. Interesting. So Calvin's hymn book was still too lively? Was that the idea? Okay. Oh, because it felt too much like circus music or that sort of thing? Fascinating. Oh, I see. So it's all strict so that it's less bouncy, playful. I see. Okay, interesting. Okay, any other questions on Bach or the Reformation or Geneva jigs? Yes, Evelyn.
I've heard something once that I don't know very much about Luther kind of developing the Passion Sonata, and that he was kind of
I'll have to look into that. I know that the English, I believe, had a lot to do with their own, like their version of the hymn. As far as Luther's, yeah, I'd have to look into, I don't have an answer off the top of my head. I'd have to look into that more. I don't know if that, possibly with his translations, he could have had something to do with that, or if that was already more or less set with the metric establishment of the time, which would just be my guess, but that's a really good question.